Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Vet Chat. This beginning our series on sustainability and regeneration, we're very fortunate today to have Craig Bennett, who is the CEO of the Wildlife Trusts. I'm sure Craig's going to tell us a little bit about himself as we start. But Craig, obviously, I really enjoyed listening to you at the recent SPIVS conference. I'm so pleased that you've agreed to come on today. And yeah, tell us a little bit about how you found the new job at the Wildlife Trust and how it's differed from Friends of the Earth, two slightly different environmental organisations, but obviously all going for improving the environment. So how are you finding the new job?
Hi, Anthony. Yeah, really good to be joining you. Well, I'm loving it, really. It sort of ended up being quite different in how I'm going about it to what I might have anticipated for obvious reasons. I actually started contractually as Chief Exec of the Wildlife Trust on April the 1st in 2020. So perhaps that was a bit of a clue that it was going to be an interesting start to the job and not quite what I expected. I thought I'd spend my first year traveling around the country, seeing lots of reserves and meeting teams in the field. But obviously, I wasn't able to do as nearly as much of that as I thought I would. And I've spent a lot of it from my attic in Cambridge, my attic study in Cambridge, and instead spending a lot of time on Zoom and Teams like so many other people. But actually, what I'm loving about it is just that sense of scale across the Wildlife Trust Federation. We're made up of 46 independent, autonomous but interdependent wildlife trusts, ranging from ones that are very local, like the Isles of Scilly, or individual cities like London and Sheffield and Rotherham and Avon Wildlife Trust, through to ones that cover whole counties, Essex and Kent and Shropshire and many others, to groups of counties, like Bedfordshire, Northamptonshire and Cambridgeshire, where I am now, to national wildlife trusts like Scottish Wildlife Trust and Ulster Wildlife Trust. So collectively, to put it in scale, we're about 3,000 staff. We're actually one of the biggest landowners in the country collectively. We have more nature reserves than McDonald's has restaurants, about 1,000 more, in fact. And we estimate that 60% of the British population live within a 3-mile walk or cycle ride of one of our reserves. So it gives you an idea of just how local we are up and down the country, as well as national. And we're in a very good place to, I think, in the decades ahead, to put nature firmly in recovery. So that's really exciting.
I think it's really exciting also to see that there are areas that you're looking to take on and really rewild as well. So I know the campaign is 30 by 30. Tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yes, well, I mean, despite the sort of work we've been doing over the years and those of other excellent nature organisations like RSPB and National Trust as well, the fact is nature is in decline still in this country. In fact, the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries anywhere in the world. If you look at the sort of things, reports like the State of Nature report that was published by a whole coalition of NGOs in late 2019, 41% of our wildlife species have fallen in abundance, and some of them very severely, since the early 1970s. So in my lifetime, we've seen this catastrophic decline in species that some of them were once common and now rare. And we all know this. You know, I remember going on family holidays in the 1970s, and you go for a long drive through England, and by the time you get to the other end, there'd be dead insects all over Dad's windscreen. Or if I'd leave my bedroom light on when I was growing up at night, you know, sooner or later it'd be surrounded by moss. That doesn't happen anymore. So many, we have experienced this huge decline in abundance of so many species. And actually, that just means nature's not working as it should, apart from anything else, as well as us losing that joy of nature that should be all around us. So it's not good enough for us just to be talking about slowing the declines in nature. In fact, it's not good enough just to talk about protecting nature. We need to stop those declines, reverse them, put nature into recovery. And we need to do that broadly in three ways. We need to make more space for nature. So actually, our reserves become the foundation for nature's recovery, and we have to get many more areas, much greater space across our countryside being protected for nature. That's where the 30 by 30 target comes in, 30% of our land and sea in recovery for nature by 2030. That's all part of a global target as well. We need to have nature abundant again, restoring nature. We need to have nature working again, things like getting our wetlands wet, make sure nature's functioning, reintroducing species that are missing that should be here, like beavers, and that can all make our countryside, our ecosystems more resilient as well. And really, we need to also then be making sure that nature is helping solve the problems that we face as society. So the role that nature can play in helping us address physical and people's physical and mental well-being, which we've really learned over the last year, the role that nature can play in sucking carbon out of the air and helping us tackle climate change, but also helping us to adapt to climate change as well, the role that nature can play in actually cleaning up pollution, for example. So if we can do those things, make more space for nature, get nature working again, and make sure it's helping deliver those nature-based solutions to the problems we face in society, then we'll be in a good place.
How do you see yourself going about that in the next 8 years? At the moment, obviously, you said there's so many nature reserves, which is fantastic. I call it the jewel in the crown. I don't know if you agree, but Lunt is like a little paradise. You know, it's not many people visit it. It's a gorgeous spot just a couple of miles down the road. So you're right, you know, there's always a nature reserve quite close. What percentage of land do you have under ownership and perhaps, you know, all of the charities like the National Trust together, what would you say at the moment was the kind of percentage of wild areas in the UK?
Well, I mean, actually, I suppose it's not so much about ownership as to just what state the nature is in. If you added up all the different designations in this country, roughly you get to something like 26%, but you only get there by including our national parks and our areas of outstanding natural beauty and so on. The problem is if you take national parks and ANOBs, those are not nature designations. They are landscape, cultural landscape designations. And that's all very good. And we can think that's a nice thing, but let's not pretend those are wildlife or nature designations. They're not. And in fact, a lot of the wildlife in our national parks is in a worse state than those outside it. I mean, take our sites of special scientific interest. Those should be our very best sites. Many of our SSSIs in national parks in a worse state than those outside them. So, I mean, we could and should be doing a better job in making sure our national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty are working for nature. But at the moment, a lot of them are not in the way that they should. If you take our sites as special scientific interest, as I said, those should be a representative sample of our very best wildlife sites. Roughly across the UK, that's sort of around 10% of our land designated that way. But our nature organisations, our statutory nature bodies like Natural England, for example, estimate that only around half of those are in good condition. So really, it's closer to, rather than 26%, and certainly not 30%, it's probably closer to around 5% of our land across the UK on average that's currently in a good state for nature. So we've got a very long way to go to get to 30% by 2030. Now, the way we think of the Wildlife Trust that needs to happen is, of course, we need to make much more space for nature by designating more sites. We've proposed a new designation called Wild Belt, so you can designate land that is currently of low biodiversity value, put it into recovery. That's going to be crucial for building a nature recovery network, in other words, creating the wildlife corridors that connect up existing reserves and creating much larger areas for wildlife as well. But crucial to this will also be obviously working with the likes of farmers, for example, and the new agricultural schemes that are being put in place now. We've worked hard to make sure that there will be that where public subsidies gets used for supporting farming in the future, that actually those public subsidies are for public goods, including nature. So the higher tiers of under the new agricultural regimes will be, hopefully, if the government delivers them right, will enable us to put nature into recovery as well. But really, a lot of this is about having those policies in place, making sure it happens in the right locations, making sure it's a protected and connected network for nature's recovery. All the way into our towns and cities and right out into the countryside, and then that we can restore the abundance of those species, say also by reducing pesticide use, just get nature working again. I believe we can do it if we are really to, you know, pull together all the resources we've got to make that happen. And it's got to happen, you know, for reconnecting people and nature again. But secondly, of course, nature is the foundation for everything that matters. You can't even have a sensible conversation about food security or agriculture if nature's in decline, which is kind of ironic because agriculture has been one of the biggest drivers of the declines in nature. So it's the foundation to food productivity. It's the foundation to our medical and to our physical and mental well-being. It's the foundation to producing clean air, clean water, and so on. So for hundreds and hundreds of reasons, we have to do this.
I think it's really interesting. I think there is a renaissance, you know, after the or during, we're still in the pandemic, but there's been a reconnection with nature from a lot of people. Obviously, last year, the roads were much quieter. We had the birds singing. I've just got a group of starlings fighting over some food outside. So great to see that. And we've obviously had a lot of people planting wildflower meadows. For example, we've planted a little one outside our office. It's only a very small area, but of course it brings the bees, it brings the butterflies in. My wife got some money off the local council to put a wildflower meadow at her school as well. And I suppose that's really where you're coming from also, from the agriculture. The use of fertilizer has turned a lot of our meadows into fairly monoculture fields that look nice from a distance, but actually don't support a great deal of wildlife, do they? Do you think that you know, we've lost the common agricultural policy. Do you see that the laws coming in, you know, from a British government now rather than a European one, can help to sort of turn around some of those policies to make it, as you say, more attractive for farmers to farm for wildlife rather than just industrially produce not necessarily always the most healthy food?
Yes, I mean, I would say there's a caution here. You're never going to hear me defending the old common agricultural policy. It had huge problems with it, of course.
Yeah.
But actually, a lot of the problems were as much with how we implemented it in the UK as it in itself, at least in recent years. I mean, you know, since changes to the common agricultural policy about 10 years ago, it wasn't just focused on food production, and it wasn't particularly good for nature, but it was kind of pretty neutral in the scheme of things. The problem was then how we interpret aspects of that in the UK that caused a lot of problems. And that's why, of course, you see such a great range across Europe, across different member states of the European Union. There's quite a big range as to how that's interpreted, and quite a big variety as to the state that nature's in across the European Union. So that kind of should be obvious. Having said all that, we are where we are, and Brexit was a great opportunity for us to shake up, you know, the agricultural policy in this country. And however people voted or what side they were on that referendum, we can all agree that there's a great opportunity to try and do something different on agriculture. And it had to happen anyway. It would have had to have happened whatever, but it did mean that in this country we could try and win that principle, which I think broadly the NGOs did win, that if you're going to use taxpayers' money to fund farming, it should be funding not for what the market can provide. In other words, not paying for food as such. Why would you subsidize that? Actually, subsidize the things the market doesn't pay for. In other words, those public goods we require, such as nature and ecosystem services and putting nature into recovery. So that argument was broadly won. There are these big opportunities now, as you say, that the new agricultural policy coming in. There's these things called environmental land management schemes. There are sort of three tiers of those. There's a sustainable farming incentive, which will be the most basic tier that says, you know, this is supporting farmers to farm, funny enough, but actually with, we hope, more stringent criteria than were under the common agricultural policy. The detail's not there yet, but we hope so. And in particularly in supporting approaches like integrated pest management, which is essentially using less pesticides when growing crops. The next tier up is supporting local nature recovery, so higher tier of payments, but to do more for wildlife. And then the big, highest tier of payments for farmers and other landowners will be landscape scale recovery. So really kind of what you might call, people might understand, the rewilding agenda. And as I said, the detail hasn't been published from government yet, bits of it emerging, but we hope when that comes, that will play a big role in really shifting things in terms of that. The approach that we've seen in farming, and to support farmers to have a good quality, you know, income and a good livelihood in doing that as well. That will be very important. You're right that I think the zeitgeist has shifted a lot over the last few years, but particularly this last year during the pandemic. At the Wildlife Trusts, around this time last year, we were experiencing a 2,000% increase in the number of people looking at our webcams from our nature reserves over the same months the year before, it was very clear that people were desperate to have their daily dose of nature and to find any way of doing it during lockdown. And I think people have come to really appreciate nature in a new way now, you know, and maybe not take it for granted so much, given how much it has been important to people during lockdown. And I think people are coming to understand the scale of the global ecological crisis, indeed the scale of the global climate crisis, and how the two are completely interlinked as well. And we can't hope to solve one without the other. So it's exciting to get this kind of renewal and excitement about the need to address these issues. The problem is these are issues where there's a ticking clock and we've got to move fast on it. You know, we cannot take forever about solving them. We've got to move fast with real urgency and treat it like the emergency it is. So the question is, can we move fast enough?
Do you see, obviously COP26 is happening later on in the year in Glasgow. I saw a programme about Greta Thunberg talking very much about the amount of carbon we've perhaps got left to pump into the atmosphere before we go above the 1.5 degrees that was kind of set as the limit at the Paris conference. Obviously, having another one of these conferences, is there a danger that, the British are hosting it, but as you say, being the least wooded country in Europe, one of the worst countries for nature degradation, that it could end up being a talk shop? How do you think that COP26 will pan out?
Well, there's always a danger when you have these international summits. They could just become a talk shop, and there's a danger, yes, world leaders come together, take a nice photograph together, not don't agree much and move on. Having said that, I do think they're essential nonetheless, and you feel with those international agreements, we perhaps inch forward sometimes, and if nothing else, hopefully we lock in, ratchet up what the lowest common denominator action is, so it's never that inspiring, but at least it is that, and that's really important. At this COP, at this Conference of the Parties, COP26 in Glasgow in November, what will be absolutely crucial, and what everyone's looking to the UK government to do, is use their diplomatic skills to try and get every country to agree to ratchet up their ambition and the effort that they're going to put into cutting carbon emissions as fast as possible, so that you keep that target of 1.5 degrees alive. Now, bear in mind, we're already at 1.1 degrees of warming above pre-industrial levels. So that's going to be tough. You know, that requires much faster cuts in emissions than we've seen to date from all countries, but particularly the rich countries that, of course, have been primarily to blame for climate change. The reason 1.5 matters is because if we go above that, it's much higher chances that we hit what's called positive feedback loops in the Earth's climate system. And they're positive feedbacks in terms of that's a sort of scientific jargon. Doesn't mean they're good. It means things like the Amazon rainforest starts to dry out even more. In fact, there's signs today, there's just news reports today that there's more evidence of that happening. And as the Amazon rainforest dries out, it becomes a source of carbon rather than a sink of carbon.
Also the ice obviously melting quicker as well, we've seen.
Exactly. If sea ice melts quicker, the white reflective surface gets replaced with dark seawater, which absorbs more of the sun's energy. When the tundra thaws and melts, that releases methane. And there's many of these positive feedback loops in the Earth system that could lead to more runaway climate change, which takes away our options to slow it in the future. So that's what's really concerning. The other thing that's often lost in this debate is this is all based on 50-50 chance of this happening. So those aren't great odds. You know, Russian roulette has better odds than 50-50. So we really have left it very late to act. So at COP26, we absolutely have to see that agreement for 1.5 and scaling up the effort to achieve that. That's going to be much easier to do if the rich countries come forward and offer the finance to the poorer countries to do that and for the technological transfer. And bear in mind, in the Paris meeting back in 2015, the rich countries promised £100 billion to do that. They haven't delivered that yet. So rich countries are really behind on this. But you also pointed, Anthony, is that what matters here is to have credibility in that. The UK as host has to be doing the right thing at home as well. And, the UK has broadly set pretty good targets on trying to tackle climate and to cut carbon emissions. Actually following through on the practice has been pretty poor. So it was only in the last month we saw the government's own climate advisors, the Climate Change Committee, advising that the government was way off track on delivering on the ground what's needed to meet its climate targets. And that's a real problem. You know, we need to see a comprehensive plan and action from government across all sectors to really deliver on its targets. It's like, you know, I always say it's like if we were hosting the Olympics in 2030 in the UK, you'd expect a very clear project plan about how it's going to be delivered with Gantt charts and milestones, and you'd know whether you're on track to deliver or not. And that's the kind of approach we need to tackling our contribution as the UK to climate change. At the moment, what we see is kind of a bunch of sporadic policies announced here and there that sound good and make the headlines. But do they, and some of them might be good, don't get me wrong, but does it add up to the emission cuts that we need to stay on track for 1.5? And that's what's missing at the moment from the government, I'm afraid.
I think we really need innovative thinking, because the incremental changes aren't probably going to be enough. So it's you know, using solar energy more, wind power, you know, to help us get to those targets. Governments move very slowly, is my impression. How much do you think that businesses can help? And obviously we have the big businesses like Microsoft and Google and Facebook and so on. But also bringing this down to the level of, you know, veterinary practices and so on, do you see there being some very easy wins that, for example, a veterinary practice should be doing to help to reduce its carbon footprint? Have you got any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, to come back to your big point there, I mean, it's funny how we often look to governments to lead, but in my experience, they don't normally. They normally follow. They normally act when they get the sense that communities, their population or business wants them to do a certain thing. Mm-hmm. So in fact, actually, the leadership on climate change, it has to come from communities. It has to come from people, communities, from businesses, small and large, and then the government will really act. And of course, it'd be so much easier if, I don't know, a green JFK walked in or something and offered that kind of hero leadership on the climate agenda. I've waited too long for that to happen. It's not going to happen. So actually, the leadership falls to all of us as individuals, as communities, as people, as veterinary practices, as companies big and small, to demonstrate that leadership in the way that is right and authentic to us and whatever roles we're playing in our lives and in the economy and in the community. And then when we see that happening, governments will speed up the action on climate, which will then become mutually reinforcing and make it easier for us to take the action we're committed to. So each of us as individuals should try and, you know, make the commitments that feel right to you, whether it's eating a bit less meat, you know, and I guess what, I eat meat, but I try and eat much less of it than I once did and eat less but better meat. That can make a huge difference. Fly a bit less, try and make sure your energy is from renewable sources, insulate your homes, all these kind of things. There's lots of things that we can do and learn about these issues, you know, make sure that you're reading around it and taking it seriously and so on. As veterinary practices, you know, I would say that the big challenge, the big opportunity out there is as many veterinary practices as possible that can commit to go net zero by 2030, the better. That's what we need. And, you know, let's have as many veterinary practices proudly saying they're committed to go net zero by 2030, which means that they are they only emit the same amount of carbon as they absorb. But really, it should be possible for most vet practices to get down to almost zero without having to worry about other approaches, you know. That should be really important. And in fact, the more that the sector as a whole, the more that the veterinary profession as a whole can commit to reach net zero by 2030, that will in itself offer real leadership. And big questions there. What about the role that veterinary surgeries, given that they are places where the community interacts, you know, the fact that if veterinary surgeries are seen, practices are seen to be adopting renewable energy, seen to be insulating their buildings well, seen to be taking these kind of steps, adopting electric vehicles, all of those kind of things, then that will have a leadership role within our communities. It will make a huge difference. And that's on carbon, on the nature side of things as well. You know, what I said at the conference was I would love to see the veterinary profession offering real leadership about trying to reduce the risk of, you know, those chemicals and those treatments that do cause problems. I mean, there's like ivermectins, which, you know, the worming treatments for use of livestock, which actually then cause real problems for bats and beetles and dung beetles, for example, as well. We've seen the use of neonicotinoids, which have been banned in agriculture because of the impact they have on bee populations, but they're still available in pet parasite products. And the problem is you get spray neonicotinoids on a dog, and a dog goes running through a water course, as mine does quite often. My Labrador loves nothing better than to go swim in the river. But if they've been sprayed with neonicotinoids, bear in mind these are chemicals that one teaspoon of them can kill 250 million bees. So, you know, how on earth have we ever ended up with using chemicals like that in these kind of treatments? We need the veterinary profession to show leadership and say it's unacceptable to be using chemicals like that and pesticides like that. We've got to find alternatives. And yes, use our bulk purchasing to say we're going to stop buying them and stop using them and support the alternatives. And that's the leadership role that this profession can play.
How do you feel about, you obviously talked about insulation, which is really interesting. I live in an old Victorian house. I've got solar panels on the roof. We just had to have them taken all off because there was a leak in the roof, but got it fixed. How do you feel about solar and wind? Wind, obviously, a bit more difficult, but also heat pumps and so on. Do you feel that they're part of the mix for businesses as well to be using those?
I mean, 100%. I mean, the thing about renewable energy, it's this whole family of technologies, and they're very exciting. And, you know, solar has its role. And you know, I've got solar panels on my house, and I reckon we generate about 2/3 of the electricity that we use every year through solar. Wind is very useful, very powerful as well. And we've seen that there's huge ability. We're seeing more and more electricity in this country generated through wind, both onshore and offshore. And of course, onshore wind is now the cheapest form of producing electricity in the UK. From any source, it's cheaper than even burning coal now, which is fantastic. So, you know, we're seeing that, for example. The thing to really understand is how that interacts both with energy efficiency. So actually, the more that we insulate our houses, the more efficient our buildings are, that or indeed our products and technology our in our kettles, buildings as yeah. well, our kettles and fridges and so on.
Yeah.
The thing that's often not understood is that actually knocks out the peaks in demand. Actually, yeah. The more we have energy efficiency. So it requires much less generating capacity overall. Yeah. And it also means that we're less reliant on storage, or it presents much greater options for a much more dynamic energy system and a smart energy system where our products, actually, like fridges and electric cars and so on, we can start to have much more localized energy storage. And we move from a very central sort of grid provision where we have a handful of big power stations, but a long way from where we consume electricity, to actually generating electricity much closer to where we use it and have a much more kind of demand management response. That is the future. That's inevitably where we're going. And the longer we cling on to big centralized old fashioned power stations, the more we're holding up the emergence of the future. So it's really exciting.
The sort of Tesla batteries and that sort of stuff as well, you think is.
Yeah, although the thing I'd really kind of point out is that all the technology we have now in terms of energy and, you know, even today's solar panels, the most modern technology we have now in relation to renewables is still the equivalent of like the brick sized mobile phones in the 1980s to smartphones today. I mean, the technological change we're going to see in this area over the next decade or so is going to be extraordinary. I mean, if you bear in mind that they've already developed solar panels that look just like normal windows, and now it's just a question of how long it takes for those to come through to market and come down in cost.
Yes.
They've developed a spray on solar that you can spray on the front of your building and you can't even detect it really. And that essentially becomes a solar panel. The possibilities here are endless, and there will be opportunities for energy in the renewable area that we can't even imagine now. And that's why I get so frustrated at how, you know, when sometimes people focus on what I consider a very old technologies like nuclear and so on, the technologies of the last century that yeah. actually remain us, keep us wedded to the past rather than unlocking all these amazing possibilities for the future.
And I think this is finishing off that loop, shows how business maybe will get us out of this more than governments will. Just one final one, Craig. I've really appreciated your time. Obviously, we're in plastic-free July. plastic is reducing. It was great to see the amount of reduction in plastic bags once we put a levy on those. Nevertheless, you know, we see animals dying with, whales dying with huge amounts of plastic in their stomachs. How do you think, we don't see the oceans as much as we see the land, but how do you think we should be developing things like the marine protected areas to really help us to take the planet forward? Because obviously the majority of our planet is covered with water. It's such an important resource. It can be forgotten about because we don't see it. We don't live in it, do we?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of points there, Anthony. Let's talk about plastics first, because I myself, you know, I've been kind of a professional environmentalist, if you like, for 25 years now. And I've been on quite a journey through my career on plastics. You know, I used to think that the answer was to promote better recycling. But, you know, in recent years, I've come to understand it's really not, because the problem is you can't really recycle plastics properly. You can to an extent, you can reuse them for other purposes. But the problem is what plastics always do is they keep continue to shed microplastic pollution. Mm. Yeah. So even if you recycle a bunch of plastic bottles into, say, a fleece, into plastic clothing, the problem is each time you're wearing it, and I've got, you know, fleeces made from recycled bottles, don't get me wrong, but, you know, you're shedding billions of tiny bits of microplastic. And we don't really understand what the long-term impact on that is on the environment or our health. I mean, there is some research, and it's early days yet, so it's still pretty speculative. But believe it or not, there's some research that actually microplastic pollution might be linked to some of the insect declines, because there's been examples of insects basically dying because of tiny, tiny, tiny microplastics being found in their stomachs. That's quite shocking. We don't know the long-term impacts of that. We don't know the long-term impacts of microplastics on our health. You know, bear in mind that microplastics are known to have toxics that adhere to them. And all of us, you, me, all of us have thousands and thousands of tiny bits of microplastic in our bodies that we, you know, don't know quite what the impact is having on us. My strong sense from talking to scientists that have worked in this field, who will tell you more when they're down the pint, down the pub with you over a pint than they would if until it's in a peer-reviewed paper. You know, a lot of scientists are very concerned about actually the long-term impact of plastics on our health. On top of that, of course, plastics are made from what? Oil and gas. They're made from fossil fuels. And we've got to phase out fossil fuels. So guess what? Really, we've got to phase out plastics. We've got to completely stop manufacturing of plastics, fossil fuels.
I agree, Craig.
Now, a lot of people think that sounds bonkers because you look at all the huge use of plastics around us. But guess what? 20 years ago, people thought it was bonkers when we said you've got to phase out fossil fuels. And now pretty much everyone agrees to that. And if we're phasing those out, we've got to phase out plastics. Now, do we have the alternative system yet? No, not necessarily. But that's why we've got to have a big goal like getting rid of plastics. And then that stimulates the research and innovation to find the appropriate solutions. And we've got to do that.
One of the problems, Craig, is that in the UK, we dump our plastics in places like Turkey, don't we? So I saw there was a whole load of plastic dumped outside of 10 Downing Street recently, because obviously we are not looking after our own rubbish, which just ethically isn't right, is it?
So it's a huge, huge problem. And I mean, it's appalling. I mean, I think future generations will look back and be astonished and appalled at how we create plastic pollution in the way that perhaps we would be astonished and appalled that once children were sent up chimneys. I mean, I do think it will be like that one day. What we take for granted now actually will be seen as absolutely appalling in future years. You asked also the question about the marine environment. Well, of course, here in the UK, 50% of our biodiversity, you could say, is found in the marine environment. Sadly, it's very badly degraded. We have overfished our seas. We have dredged pretty much every bit of the coast, and it's in a highly degraded form. And yet, you know, if we could only put our marine environment into recovery, not only is that fantastic for biodiversity, but it would really help us address the climate crisis as well. Because actually, when you see if fish populations are growing fast, that's all sucking carbon out of the air. If seagrasses, if kelp and so on are growing fast, and it's doing the same thing. So actually, around 30% of our seas around the coast of Britain are theoretically designated marine protected areas at the moment. That's good. Sadly, those are very weak and they're basically paper parks. They don't really exclude any extractive activities. So at the Wildlife Trust, we've been campaigning hard for highly protected marine areas, which would exclude extractive activities such as dredging and fishing. And this is critically needed. It's not to say that you exclude that everywhere, but if we can have properly protected marine areas up to around 30% of our sea area, then we will start to see fish populations rebounding and fish populations growing fast. Of course, that will be good for fishermen operating outside those areas anyway, but actually more to the point, we will just start perhaps to start recovering the abundance of our fish populations and other parts of the marine environment in a way that starts to mean we have a sort of seascapes and a marine environment that starts to approximate to what it should be, at least in some areas. But there's a very long way to go on that.
It's sensible, it's sustainability, which if we do it right, leads to regeneration, doesn't it? Which I think is obviously what we need in the country. Craig, that's been really splendid. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. I think it's so important somehow to have some optimism within there as well. You know, there are some nice stories, obviously the regenerating and the rewilding revolution that I think is, you know, happening obviously in the Wildlife Trust, also the lovely book by Isabel Tree, which I think has encouraged a lot of us to do what we can do, because obviously as an individual, I'm not a government, but I can act locally and then think globally, as I think it was Greenpeace that said. So leave us with one last optimistic message, if you can.
Well, it is this, really, Anthony. You know, I am an optimist about this, which lots of people find hard, given so much my job is focusing on the problems. But actually, I couldn't do this job if I didn't, and I couldn't start this job every day if I didn't believe that change was possible. More to the point, I believe there is an inherent logic, and there is an inherent sense that as we really get going on this transition, it will speed up. If you look at the last year and the lessons we've learned from this appalling pandemic, you know, actually we learned that humans are capable of incredible things when we really put our mind to it. We didn't think it was possible to build hospitals in a period of weeks or months rather than years. We didn't think it was possible to both develop, let alone roll out vaccines in a period of months rather than many, many years. We don't know how quickly we can tackle the climate crisis and the ecological crisis. Guess what? We haven't really tried yet. The moment we get serious about it, the moment that as a whole society, we really, really put our shoulder into this and really put effort into it, I think we will surprise ourselves about how quickly we can turn things around. But we've really got to go for it.
And let's hope in 5 years' time we look at the pandemic as being a time of terrible sacrifice, but maybe a blessing somewhere that it made us rethink and start to recalibrate.
I think surely, you know, the most fitting way to remember all those family members and friends and colleagues that have passed away in the last year because of this pandemic will surely be to do things differently. And surely will be to kind of create a better future where, actually, we shouldn't forget, of course, why the pandemic emerged in the first place. Almost certainly, it's been a zoonotic escape from spillover wildlife populations. 20, 30 years ago, scientists were warning that if we kept fragmenting wildlife habitats around the world, particularly in the tropics and trading in endangered species and so on, that would lead to increased frequency of pandemics. And we saw that with Nipah, SARS, Ebola, and more recently, COVID-19, of course. Surely the real way to pay tribute to the millions of people around the world that have died the last year because of COVID is to reverse the declines in nature, to put nature into recovery, to deal with the ecological crisis and the climate crisis. And then hopefully we might lead to a better life for humans as well.
No, thank you so much, Craig. That's been excellent. I hope you have a great rest of the day. Take care.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.